Hilversum in Holland, this is Radio Netherlands Worldwide, broadcasting via shortwave, satellite and the internet. Now, news and current affairs from Newsline.
Hello, I'm Dave McGuire.
And I'm Jill Woodward. Coming up in the program, East Timor's president is in critical condition after being shot by rebel soldiers.
NATO faces meltdown over troops for Afghanistan.
We can only prevail in Afghanistan if all of the allies are working together on the basis of one NATO strategy. One team, one mission, in together, out together.
And the controversial former Dutch politician Ian Hirschi Ali seeks citizenship in France.
All those stories and more coming up on this edition of Newsline. But first, the president of East Timor, José Ramos Horta, has been shot in an assassination attempt by anti-government rebel soldiers. He was hit 3 times in the stomach and chest and flown to Australia for medical attention, where he's in critical but stable condition. 2 of the gunmen were killed in the attack, including the leader of the group, Major Alfredo Reynado. In a separate attack, the car of the prime minister, Shanana Gushmao, was also shot at by rebels. The prime minister has since declared a state of emergency. Earlier, I spoke with John Virgo of the International Crisis Group. He told me about the rebel soldiers who were blamed for this morning's attack.
In 2006, there was a major political crisis in East Timor, and part of that crisis saw about a third of the military being dismissed and others deserting from their posts. And they joined up with this figure, Major Alfredo Reynado, who had actually also left his post. He was a military policeman, essentially in disgust at the government. So they've all been lurking around in the hills around Dili for nearly 2 years now, causing a lot of security problems for the country.
Now, this rebel group of ex-military members, do they have a political aim? Are they a political organization that wants to take over? This seems like it was a coup attempt, but do they have any idea for how to run the country?
No. I'm not sure that they ever had any real agenda, but what they do have, and what they've, or certainly what they have developed, is they had developed themselves into a symbol of opposition to the current political order in East Timor. From Renato's perspective, that was probably just a convenient flag for him to wave. But there's no doubt that a lot of people in East Timor, many of whom are very disillusioned with their leaders, did see him as an opposition figure, almost standing up for them against the political classes of East Timor.
And this new government that came in August had the same cast of characters as previous governments, but they had said that they were really going to make an effort to solve this problem and put an end to the divide that was threatening the stability of the country.
They have. I mean, everybody's recognized that Reynado and his men posed probably the major threat to security in East Timor. And the government have been trying to do various things with them in maybe not a very coordinated fashion. There's been the threat of legal action against Reynado. There's been the threat of military action against him. But there's also been a series of attempts to talk to him, to dialogue with him, in which both the president and the prime minister have been involved.
And now he's apparently dead. Do you think this will lead to some sort of collapse of this rebellion, or do you think it'll just fracture into even more instability?
I think one of two things could happen, and I don't know where I put my money at the moment. One is that with Reynado gone, the movement could more or less melt away. There certainly are a lot of grievances against the government, and I'm sure we're going to see those expressing themselves in the future, but it's sort of having almost an organized rebel movement in the hills, it could disappear. On the other hand, it could just coalesce around new leaders. The people who carried out the attack on Shanan Gusmao, the prime minister's convoy, got away this morning. And who knows, maybe they might be at the center of a new coalition of forces.
John Virgo is Southeast Asia Project Director with the International Crisis Group. He was speaking on the phone from Jakarta.
And staying in Indonesia, the former executive director of the national airline Garuda has been sentenced by a Jakarta court to 1 year in jail for assisting in the killing of human rights activist Munir Said Talib. The court found Indra Setiawan guilty of falsifying documents to help the killer travel on Mr. Munir's flight. Last month, Parlikarpus Priyanto was sentenced to 20 years in prison for poisoning the human rights activist with arsenic while on a flight from Jakarta to Amsterdam. Priyanto was a Garuda pilot, but traveled on the flight as a passenger. The Indonesian intelligence services have been implicated in the killing of Mr. Munir, who was a leading critic of human rights abuses in Indonesia.
South Korea's most prized national treasure, the capital's Great Southern Gate, has been partly destroyed by fire. The wooden superstructure of the 14th-century landmark in Seoul collapsed, leaving only the stone base. The Great Southern Gate served as the city's main entrance when it became Korea's capital more than 600 years ago. The South Korean authorities have detailed plans of the gate and say it will take 3 years to rebuild the structure. And you're listening to Newsline from Radio Netherlands Worldwide.
The U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates has warned NATO allies about the danger of failure in Afghanistan. He said violence and terrorism could surge worldwide if NATO failed to stamp out the resurgent Taliban. He also made a direct appeal to Europeans to support the ISAF mission there. But until now, his appeals have fallen largely on deaf ears, raising serious fears about the future of the alliance. Vanessa Mock reports.
Robert Gates, the U.S. Defense Secretary, has a stark message for Europe's men and women. Lose in Afghanistan at your peril.
Many Europeans question the relevance of our actions and doubt whether the mission is worth the lives of their sons and daughters. So now I would like to add my voice to those of many allied leaders on the continent and speak directly to the people of Europe. The threat posed by violent Islamic extremism is real, and it is not going to go away.
Robert Gates referred to a string of recent terror plots in Spain, Britain, Belgium, and Germany to drum home the threat of what he calls al-Qaedaism. He made his appeal during a high-level security conference in Munich, right after a highly charged NATO summit in Vilnius. Despite repeated calls for more European allies to step up to the plate, only France has offered up some more military support to fight the Taliban in the south. And that's not nearly enough. NATO leaders worry that this is becoming a two-tiered alliance, with only some members doing the fighting and the dying.
We can only prevail in Afghanistan if all of the allies are working together on the basis of one NATO strategy.
NATO Secretary General Jaap de Hoopschreffer.
One team, one mission. In together, out together.
The finger has implicitly been pointed at Germany recently, which has around 3,200 peacekeepers in the relatively peaceful north of Afghanistan. Mr. Gates ruffled feathers in Berlin last week when he fired off a letter asking, or even demanding, Germany to support the Dutch, the British and the Americans fighting in the south. Germany's refused because of the huge unpopularity of sending its soldiers out to fight. Janne Haaland Matlary, a politics professor in Oslo, says it's a missed opportunity.
Clearly nobody thinks Germany is serious in the NATO setting. Your military contribution equals your political influence.
But Ruprecht Polenz, the head of the Foreign Affairs Committee in the German Parliament, disagrees.
You know, we made quite clear that from the beginning, Germany is very engaged in helping the Afghan people to provide security for the Afghan citizens. And we are the third largest troop contributor.
NATO is in a tight spot. The alliance's woes run even deeper. It's got money problems because at the moment it's only the countries that fight that actually pay for the cost of the mission. And what started out as a mission to stabilize Afghanistan has turned into NATO's first ever ground war. But it hasn't even secured the support it needs from the EU and other civilian organizations like the United Nations. Professor Janne Haaland Matlary again.
Nobody blames the UN here, but the UN is the real culprit in not having supplied civilian tools, in not being present. So there has to be an increase in military efforts, yes, but there has to be much more increase on the civilian side.
NATO leaders will come up with a new Afghanistan strategy at their summit in Bucharest in April, which is when they'll also hope to secure more troop pledges. Because unless it manages to get its allies to pull together, NATO may well be pulled apart in future.
And that was our Brussels correspondent, Vanessa Mock, reporting. And you're listening to Newsline from Radio Netherlands Worldwide.
Time now for a look at the stories making the headlines here in the Netherlands. The Dutch Public Prosecutor's Office has asked that Guus Kouwenhove be sentenced to 20 years in prison for arms smuggling and war crimes during the Liberian Civil War. The public prosecutor is also demanding that he pay a fine of 450,000 euros. Mr. Kawanhova was said to have committed the war crimes between 2000 and 2003. The arms were allegedly smuggled to the regime of former Liberian President Charles Taylor. In 2006, Mr. Kawanhova received an 8-year jail sentence for arms smuggling to Liberia, but was acquitted of war crimes charges for lack of evidence. The public prosecutor's office is appealing the ruling.
The Somali-born author and former Dutch politician Ayaan Hirsi Ali has appealed worldwide for help to fund her protection. Her wishes might just soon be realized as French politicians and intellectuals come to the rescue. Now, back in 2004, she collaborated with Theo van Gogh on the short film Submission, which examines the link between Islamic law and the suffering of millions of women under Islam. Van Gogh was murdered by a Dutch Islamic extremist, and Ayaan Hirsi Ali has been living under 24-hour protection since then. After resigning from the Dutch parliament, Ms. Hirsi Ali moved to the United States, and last year the Dutch government decided it would no longer fund her personal security when she's abroad. Radio Netherlands Paris correspondent Frank Renaud heard her speak in Paris and told Fiona Campbell about France's offer.
Well, Ayaan Hirsi Ali has been explaining that she's been looking for her own funds to pay for her own protection since October last year, when the Dutch government decided not to pay for that protection anymore once she is abroad. And as we know, she's working in the United States. Well, France offered her to pay for her protection, but said, if so, we want you to become a French citizen. And that's why Hirsi Ali came to France. And she explained it herself like this.
It's the outrage expressed by French intellectuals at the decision of the current Dutch administration to stop protecting me that gives me strength and hope. Strength to go on voicing injustices against women carried out in the name of Islam, and hope that my life will be protected. If not by the Dutch government, then hopefully by the French government.
And why, Frank, in your opinion, is she now in France? She seems to have been given a lot of support there, especially from the French intellectual elite. Why has she struck such a chord in France, do you think?
Well, there are two main reasons. First of all, there's Nicolas Sarkozy, the French president, who offered last year to protect all women worldwide who are oppressed. And that's what Ayaan Hirsi Ali has been repeating in Paris. He says, well, it's the French president Sarkozy who has been saying this. Second, there is a big group of left-wing intellectuals who are supporting her, who are supporting her struggle. They say, in France we have a tradition of a human right, of protecting people around the world who are oppressed once they defend human rights. And we want to defend Hirsi Ali as well, because it's very strange. It's a European citizen. She has a European nationality, the Dutch nationality, and she's not protected.
And you have spoken to Ayaan Hirsi Ali yourself. I mean, how frustrated is she about all this?
And she says, the only thing I want to do is do my work and stay alive. That's how she states it. And she says, it's very strange, because since October she has hardly been doing any normal work, but the only thing she's doing is traveling around the world to collect her proper funds to pay for her protections. But that's not the way she wants to live her life, she says.
And what about Holland? I mean, have they responded to this in any way? Are they feeling any feelings of shame, the fact that she's had to go to such lengths to ensure her own safety, her own protection?
Well, the Dutch government has made a clear statement saying last year that they don't pay for her protection once she's abroad. There's no debate anymore on that in the Netherlands, which is very strange for the French indeed to see when a Dutch citizen with a Dutch passport is not protected by her own country. And that is what France is offering her. Once she becomes a French citizen with the French nationality, they will protect her worldwide as they do with all her citizens.
That was our Paris correspondent, Frank Renaud. And those are some of the stories making the news here in the Netherlands. You'll find more news on our website at radionetherlands.nl. And coming up here on Radio Netherlands After Newsline.
This week on Curious Orange, Peter R. de Vries is the Dutch reporter who got Joran van der Sloot to talk on video about the last hours of Natalie Holloway's life.
We'll find out a bit more about de Vries and his controversial methods for getting confessions and for making headlines.
We'll also find out about the financial bottom line here in Holland. What is too much for the Dutch?
And of course, we'll feature music throughout the show. This week, we'll be listening to Graham.
That's this week on Curious Orange.
You're listening to Newsline from Radio Netherlands Worldwide with Dave McGuire and me, Jill Woodward. The Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan has warned Turks living in Germany not to assimilate into German society. While addressing a political rally of 16,000 in Cologne, he went as far as saying assimilation was a crime against humanity. Prime Minister Erdogan was in Germany for the funerals of the 9 Turks who died during a fire in Ludwigshafen. So, how seriously should his comments be taken, and what will it do to already tricky tensions between Germans and Turks? Newsline's Fiona Campbell spoke to Turkey commentator Dick Koopman for his opinion.
I think that he was trying to give a very positive message to the Turkish population, in that sense that before his remarks on assimilation, he urged the Turks to learn German, to behave according to the standards and values of the German society. But, and then I think we get a debatable point about what he meant, he referred to assimilation and said something like that being an offense against humanity. My interpretation would be that he very much meant the religious backgrounds of the Turks, and that he may have referred to discussions which are now current in Europe about Islam and the implications of presence of Islam in Europe, and that he wanted to give a warning that giving up your identity as being a good Muslim and a good Turk would be something that was not acceptable.
And he was in Germany, he was in Ludwigshafen for the funeral of the 9 Turks that died during the housing fire. And one assumes that he took this opportunity to address problems he sees with Turks living in Germany. I mean, he had a big crowd.
Yeah, sure.
How influential do you think his words are going to be?
I think his words are rather influential, not only because he took a very emotional setting, but also because he held his speech in Cologne, in the same stadium where his predecessors from Islamic-orientated parties had their conferences with the people.
And also in his speech he was calling for Turkish schools and also for Turkish universities. I mean, in the current climate in Germany, how is this appeal for more Turkish influence in the country going to go down, do you think?
Well, I think that for many Germans, that is not a positive message. On the other hand, it is consistent with Turkish politics up till now, because they wanted to show to Europe that they, as an Islamic country, are very acceptable as a nation of Europe. And this position of defending your own languages and culture within a European context is accepted all over Europe.
That was Dick Koopman, retired professor and Turkey specialist.
Now, some other international stories we're following here on Newsline. Spanish police have arrested 13 members of the Basque separatist party Batasuna for belonging to an illegal organization. The Spanish authorities banned Batasuna in 2003, saying it was a front for the armed separatist movement ETA. Among those arrested are Batasuna leaders Carmelo Landa and Mikel Echaburo. ETA began an armed struggle for self-determination for the Basque people in 1968.
At least 6 people were killed in Pakistan's province of North Waziristan earlier today when a suicide bomber drove his car into a group of campaign workers. Among those killed was a candidate named Nasir Ali, who was campaigning for the 18th of February parliamentary elections. Since the beginning of the year, more than 400 people have been killed in suicide attacks and fighting between the army and Islamic rebels. The parliamentary elections were originally scheduled to take place in December, but were postponed following the assassination of opposition leader Benazir Bhutto at an election rally in December. And just a reminder, you're listening to Newsline on Radio Netherlands Worldwide.
Well, the U.S. presidential primaries continue their slow march across the country. A big weekend for Barack Obama has put him at a veritable draw with Hillary Clinton in the all-important race to get the most nominating delegates. Excitement for the Democratic process is high. Some states are reporting record turnout for the voting, with some towns experiencing traffic jams as people head to the polls. Sunday, it was Maine's turn to voice their opinion through the obscure method of caucusing. The town of Chabig Island, Maine, has a year-round population of 350 people. Over 50 of them turned out to the caucus in the cold. But they weren't deterred by the weather, as I heard from one of the caucus organizers, Donna Damon.
As we were heading into the caucus, all of a sudden it started to really snow, at great big gigantic flakes, but it did not keep people from coming.
So what's the caucus process like? Are there speeches? Is there debating? What was the evening like?
What has to happen is you have to be checked in to make sure you're really a registered Democrat. And so we had 14 people who actually joined the Democratic Party so they could participate. And then we jumped right into the presidential caucus, and we just said, who would like to speak about Hillary Clinton? Who would like to speak about Barack Obama? And we probably had 15 people who spoke in combination of the two, about the two candidates.
And were they eloquent speakers? Did people practice what they were going to say?
We had some people who really gave actually pretty long speeches and went into historical comparisons with Lincoln and Kennedy and talked about the passion for Obama, for example. Then we had other ones who just talked right off the cuff. And it came right out of, you know, how they were moved at the moment to speak. And we had one person who stood up. He was a lobsterman. And he said, an old lobsterman told him once that you get more lobsters when there's a Democratic president than a Republican president. And so he said that he would vote for a Democrat no matter what. And so that was a little bit of levity, a little bit of main humor.
So what was the final tally of the night?
It was 38 for Obama. And 14 for Clinton, and 2 uncommitted.
So do you think the Democrats that were there last night were bitterly divided by the end of the night? Or do you think that no matter who wins the nomination, the Democrats of Shebig, Maine are going to support them?
That was definitely the message the last speaker, who happened to be me, was talking about. No matter who wins, that was the main idea.
That was Donna Damon. She helped organize the Democratic caucus in the small town of Shebig Island, Maine. Tuesday, Democrat voters head to the polls in Virginia, Maryland, and Washington, D.C. And now we'll take some time to take a look through the Dutch newspapers. My colleague Dave has been doing that. Dave, what do you have?
Well, Dutch speed skating fans are rejoicing at the 2 all-round gold medals won by Sven Kramer and Pauline van Dortekom at Berlin's World Championships. Photos of the victorious duo are on most of the front pages. AD shows a photo of the two wearing laurel wreaths and holding up their gold medals.
Now I hear Pauline van Dortekom was something of an outsider.
Yeah, De Volkskrant focuses on the surprise win by the 27-year-old. She's never won a title in the four-discipline competition. Up to now, she was seen as merely a good sparring partner for former all-round world champion Irene Fust, who was left in tears after the first race. 5 years ago, Miss van Dortekom even wanted to stop skating. The paper describes her not as a natural talent, but as having strong legs and an effective style, which is also a description used for me. Her advice to the less talented skaters among us is train hard and enjoy your sport.
Okay, besides enjoying their sport, what else did the Dutch do this weekend?
Well, they watch TV. For weeks, the Dutch have been glued to their televisions, watching the latest hit in reality television. It's called Farmer Seeks Wife. If you haven't seen the show or heard about it, each week the show has a farmer. They vote people off. It's one of those dating types things. And it's been getting record viewing statistics. And people throughout the country have been watching them. Last night, I was not one of them. But I have read that of the 4 remaining farmers, one of them dropped out earlier, there's Farmer Hank. He failed to woo either of the final contestants and sent them both home. Farmer Gerard was caught kissing on film in the cow shed. I don't think he was kissing a cow. So he's highly tipped to win. Farmer Franz, who's never had a long-term relationship, fell in love with a woman by the name of Ronella. And the farm girl Agnes had to disappoint one of her 2 suitors, who were both eager to take her hand. Next week, the roles will be reversed and the farmers will meet their potential in-laws. It sounds riveting, and if you aren't able to see it, don't worry, because the Dutch, they export beer and reality TV, so I'm sure the program will be packaged and sold on to a television station near you sometime soon.
Yeah, well, it sounds like a surreal soap opera, so What if this all doesn't work out?
Well, they can rest assured because there was something in Utrecht over the weekend that would help any farmers who seek wives and then maybe wives of farmers who seek not to be around the farmers anymore. It's a divorce trade fair. AD describes the atmosphere at the trade fair in Utrecht as uneasy. De Volkskrant points out that most of the 1,000 visitors were either reporters or professionals in the branch, and the average age was 40 and above.
Okay, I'm a bit confused, but suffice to say divorce is not in the air?
Well, on the contrary, last month there were reports that applications for divorce had risen explosively. De Volkskrant says the business of splitting up has become a lucrative one. One mediator explains U.S. research shows if a bad relationship doesn't improve after a holiday or Christmas, it's actually over. So it's probably no accident then that the divorce trade fair was timed for February, before the warm weather makes people think of love, I guess. If they had moved it a few weeks forward, it could have been positively bustling after Valentine's Day.
Okay, well, I guess a holiday pretty much dooms the relationship.
And apparently, it's pretty cynical. But
who knows what effect Valentine's Day might have on the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, thanks, Dave, for that look through the newspapers. That's all the time we have on Newsline. From me, Jill Woodward, my colleague Dave McGuire, and the rest of the Newsline team, thanks for listening.
Listening to Radio Netherlands Worldwide, broadcasting via the World Radio Network to Asia and via SAFM to South Africa. We can also be heard via satellite and the internet. Our website address, www.radionetherlands.nl.
And welcome to Curious Orange, the show with an insider's
and an outsider's
look at Dutch quirks and curiosities. I'm Michel Walraven, the insider, the Nederlander.
And I'm Ashley Elson, the outsider, the Canadian. This week on the show, bad news from the Netherlands. It's not a headline, it's a blog. And we'll talk to the creator, Dr. Manfred Gerstenfeld, and ask what's his problem.
And the Dutch are famous for their careful handling of their money, and also for being a welfare state. We'll look at how this plays out on the big scale, and how the gap between haves and have-nots is widening in modern-day Holland.
We've had a couple of instances where CEOs of companies that either have had a bad year have gone home with very, very big bonuses. And that's bothered people. They don't think people should be rewarded for doing a bad job.
And of course, we'll feature music throughout the show. This week, we'll be listening to Graham.
But first, here in Holland, the big news that everybody's talking about is the video of Jeroen van der Sloot, the man accused and acquitted of the murder of Natalie Holloway.
Now, she's the American teenager that disappeared in Aruba some 3 years ago.
That's right. Now, I have to admit, I kind of missed the big event when they aired this video on TV.
It was huge. 7 million people were watching this show. Now, considering that there's about 17 million people living in the Netherlands, and when you subtract the little kids, the babies, about half the population watched this program.
It's a big deal.
It's a really big deal. Of course, the video is a big deal in the case, but the man behind the video is kind of a legend here in the Netherlands, Peter R. de Vries, crime reporter. Here to tell us more about the story is Radio Netherlands newsroom chief, Robert Chessel. Robert, welcome to Curious Orange.
Hello, Michelle. Hello, Ashley.
Hey. So let's start with a little background. What's happened so far in the case? Take us from then till now.
Okay, well, 3 years ago, an American high school student, Natalie Holloway, went missing on the island of Aruba, a former Dutch colony. Jeroen van der Sloot, a Dutch man who grew up on the island of Aruba, in fact, he is the last person known to have been seen with Natalie Holloway. Certainly, as far as we know, the last person who saw her alive. He was taken in for questioning. Authorities suspected him very very strongly, but still were unable to pin anything on him. And he ended up getting off the hook, basically, and came back to the Netherlands. Very recently, just a few months ago, Joran van der Sloot was arrested and sent back to Aruba once again for questioning. This was after the Aruban authorities said that they had new evidence in which Joran van der Sloot had apparently said things which incriminated himself. But again, they were unable